I'm Charlie Mays, and this morning we're going to be talking about Jeremiah, and we're going to do it under the rubric of do good and live as a question. When we started our discussions on Monday about looking at the Old Testament, and particularly Deuteronomic theology, we said that essentially Deuteronomy says that if one wishes to prosper, to know prosperity or at least a slice of God's shalom, one should obey God, and things would turn out well. And then we said that as that theology develops in time, people begin to raise some questions about it. In the book of Jeremiah, in my judgment, at least this will be the perspective that we're bringing to Jeremiah, is that he starts to ask questions about that, because for all of his complaining and everything else, Jeremiah is obedient. He is obedient in an exceptional kind of way, and things don't turn out well for him. So, do good and live. Can you depend on that promise? That's kind of what we want to look at. Also, the second session this week, we looked at holy war, and we saw God as a God, because he is a righteous God who wishes justice for his whole creation, that he will both fight for us and against us. And Jeremiah is a prophet who, I think, lifts that up for us. And then we looked yesterday at Micah, who is a historical antecedent in many ways to Jeremiah. And so there is some logic to the way that the week has been laid out. There's no way this morning that we're going to get half done with what I want to do in terms of looking at the life and ministry of Jeremiah. Tomorrow, and that's why I have up on the upper right-hand corner of this, those passages are the so-called confessions, or I think better to be called the complaints of Jeremiah. That's what we're going to look at tomorrow, and you might find it very helpful to depend on your reading and not my interpretation. So I invite you to jot that down and to spend a little bit of time between now and tomorrow, if you're going to be here, to look at those complaints. I found a book in the bookstore. It's also, I think, in the library here by Elie Wiesel, called Five Biblical Portraits, one of whom is Jeremiah. Elie Wiesel is a Jew, a survivor of the Holocaust, who has tried through his literature to make sense of that event. And I find him to be a terribly helpful person in my faith struggles. His absolutely beautiful Night is a book that I come back to time and again, to try to struggle with what faith means and how one lives it out. And also, because he's Jewish, he is able to engage some literature and to take seriously some tradition that is utterly foreign to us as Christians. And I think it really helps us to enter into dialogue with the Bible. Because Elie Wiesel, one of the things I most love about him is the way he argues with the Bible. It's just a marvelous statement of faith. And I think Jeremiah is, in many ways, in that sense, his spiritual ancestor. I want to read just a couple things from this little essay that he has on Jeremiah, and we'll come back to some more of it tomorrow. The first one is an apologetic for the way that I do Bible study. You know, I have mentioned that we will consider it to be a success if you come out of these Bible studies more confused than you went in. That's really what I'm really attempting to do, so that you will have some questions, so that the Word addresses your questions and not just questions and answers. He just, as a little statement, makes this observation. What does one do when confronted by a difficult and obscure text? One reads it again and again and discovers another layer beneath the visible, another dimension, another meaning, and ultimately, one makes peace with its hidden significance. I read a book a couple months ago entitled Jesus' Audiences, and he pointed out that you know, for the for the Oriental mind, there isn't just one meaning to things. And just think about that, what that means when Jesus tells parables, that things don't mean just one thing. That allows for lots of heresy and a lot of fun and a lot of interest. And that's what I think we ought to be about in Bible study. Now, more to the point of Jeremiah. He picks up an extra canonical story and tells it to begin his little thing on Jeremiah. And it came to pass that when Jerusalem was destroyed, God entered the burning sanctuary. He saw it in flames and began to weep. And he said to Jeremiah, who stood nearby, "Why are you not weeping? I am like the father whose only son died on the day of his wedding during the ceremony. And you, Jeremiah, feel no pain, neither for the father nor the son. Go, Jeremiah, go wake up the fathers of my people. Wake up Abraham and Isaac and Jacob. And Moses, wake him too. Tell them I wish to see them. I need them because they know how to weep." So a story about Jeremiah being unable to weep. And he will play with that theme throughout this little essay. And then he comes to this end. And this is a story that we will just in passing look at today. One day the prophet's faithful friend and scribe, Baruch ben Nira, was arrested and brought before the king, who wanted to read Jeremiah's book. The scene took place in the royal winter palace. The king stood before the fireplace and read Jeremiah's tales and then destroyed them. Calmly, systematically, he would read one scroll and throw it into the flames, take the next, until finally Jeremiah's masterpiece was reduced to ashes. Any other writer would have lost his mind. Not Jeremiah. He simply began writing the book all over again, adding the story of destruction to the first version. And therein lies Jeremiah's ultimate lesson for all tellers of tales. To rewrite is more difficult and more important than to write. To transmit is more vital than to invent. And what are we doing, we writers, we witnesses, we Jews? For over 3,000 years we have been repeating the same story, the story of a solitary prophet who would have given anything, including his life, to be able to tell another kind of tale, one filled with joy and fervor, rather than sorrow and anguish. But he transmitted only what he received, and so do we. And if God was angry at him for not weeping, we are not. Quite the contrary, we are proud of him. The world was not worthy of his tears or ours. I think that really gets at least something I want to bring out in Jeremiah. The material on the board, first of all, is a very rough, very broad outline, and I could care less whether you copy it down. It probably would be less helpful to do that, but it's an attempt to, in a broad way, to make some sense of the material. When we went through Jeremiah recently in my congregation, even though we'd been working on the Old Testament for almost a year, people just got almost, they almost gave up in total despair to sit down and read the book in one setting or in two settings, just to plow through it. And I will admit it is difficult when you look at it in mass. But if you begin to see that there is some kind of an outline to it, some kind of organization, I think it begins to help. Roughly in the first 25 chapters, you have oracles or speeches. It's almost as if the person who finally compiled it, whether it was Baruch at Jeremiah's direction or somebody later on, said, "Now, we have here a lot of sermons by this guy, so we're going to give you the sermons, and then later on we're going to kind of give you the context for them." We probably would have liked to have kind of told his biography and stuck in the sermons as they came along, but unfortunately that wasn't their mindset, evidently. Then we meet, actually, from chapter 26 through 45, third-person narratives that Duane indicated. We get autobiographical as well as biographical material that deals with Jeremiah as if somebody were off stage watching this drama that is happening and recording it. I've divided it in two sections because the first part of it deals with his ministry before the siege of Jerusalem, and then in the heart of it, 37 to 45, we're dealing with what was going on in Jeremiah's ministry and the suffering that he went through during the siege and after the fall of Jerusalem. Then 46 to 51, the prophecies against nations. And then 52 is really a repeat of 2 Kings 24 through the 30th verse of 25. It's kind of interesting to me that even as 1 Isaiah ends with a parallel from the book of Kings, the story of Hezekiah and Isaiah, so does this one end with tying them to that historical material. I think they want us to see some bookends. The other material that's down below in the red comes from an article in the April 1983 edition of Interpretation, which is a Bible of Journal and Theology out of Union Seminary, Richmond, Virginia. The whole volume is devoted to Jeremiah. And I really commend it to anybody that's interested in looking at a review of the recent literature. Walter Biergemann has an article in there on Jeremiah, and these descriptions come from Biergemann's article in that journal. And I'll just share it very quickly so that we'll get a sense of what, again, my perspective will be on this. Biergemann says you cannot read Jeremiah without realizing that he is overwhelmingly God's person. Somebody said, before he was born, God knew him. And the question we'll want to ask ourselves, whether that really is unmitigated good news, what it means to be set apart for God in this kind of world even before you have a chance to vote on it. Wasn't Jeremiah never went to a Billy Graham crusade. And then he is a speaker with poetic passion and stunning imagination. One of the things that I'm angry with people like Jeremiah about is that they use these brilliant images, and then everybody in the world thinks those are the only biblical images. And if you don't use the same images, you're not preaching biblically, without ever thinking that when Jeremiah used the images, they weren't biblical at all. He got them right off of the street, right out of the farm, right wherever they were handy, right out of the potter's shop. And if we preachers could get free of the biblical images, we could have biblical images again. That's a little sermon. But Jeremiah, his images are taken from life, and they're brilliant images, and we'll look at some of those. Now, Jeremiah's ministry is one involved in public events. And he sees these public events or history as the arena of God's free activity. Then in looking at history in terms of it being the arena of God's activity and being involved in public events, Jeremiah unabashedly took sides. We'll look at that. And he took... The only way I can imagine that it would have sounded in one place that we'll look at in a few minutes, Jeremiah says, Nebuchadnezzar, he says from God's lips, Nebuchadnezzar, my Evid, my servant. That would be as if some preacher in the United States stood up and said, Andropov, my servant. Or somebody in Russia said, Reagan, my servant. Jeremiah took sides, and he took them unambiguously. You never wondered where he was coming down, like some of us preachers are real good at. But he wasn't sophisticated enough. Then this word of God impinges upon public leadership, and he just drove the princes bananas. Because he didn't go to the East Room and say what he was invited to say. When Zedekiah wanted to see him and would either sneak off to prison or have him snuck back in, and wanting some good word, Jeremiah gave him a good word. It just didn't happen to be the word that Zeddy wanted to hear. Then the other thing we've talked about already too, he is a person of intense dispute. He wouldn't have lasted as the pastor of a suburban congregation more than a month. Because when the folks needed to hear it, they heard it. And so he is in conflict with the royal apparatus, with his contemporary counterparts. When he went to pastoral conference, they always cringed when he raised his hand. And his own family and kinsfolk, they weren't real happy with him. And then finally, also, as somebody's indicated, God himself. And we're gonna spend all of tomorrow on the complaints and his dealing with Yahweh. And the reason I want to do that, and I'll just be really upfront with that, is that I believe a remark that I heard Douglas John Hall make, and it's also in one of his books, and he says that he believes our worship would be far more authentic if once in a while we allowed for complaint. It would certainly be more biblical if you believe the Psalms, if they are the hymn book of the Bible. And you even look at the ministry of Jesus in terms of being in Gethsemane. There were things he didn't want to do. He told God about that. And Jeremiah is the prime example of what it means to engage God. And so we'll spend a whole time on that. Okay, enough of that background. Now let's actually look at Jeremiah for a moment. Jeremiah's name is somewhat in dispute, although in the material I've been able to read, I would say the best scholarship, in my judgment, says Jeremiah's name probably means Yahweh exalts. And it has as its etymological background the idea of opening of the womb, the word exalt. And so that might tie in with Jeremiah's "Before you were born, I knew you." But also, since vowel pointings were not use in Jeremiah's time, by pointing the word a little bit better, a little bit better in terms of my perspective I want to bring. Jeremiah's name might also mean something like this: Yahweh shoots, or Yahweh hurls. And you can see Yahweh hurling Jeremiah at his people. Literally, he is the cannon fodder. But you can, the better, I'm sure, academically, the better case is made for Jeremiah's name meaning Yahweh exalts. Who is Jeremiah? We look at the first verses of Jeremiah, and we meet some details that most of us want to skip over. But they are helpful, I think, in understanding some of Jeremiah's background. Jeremiah, perhaps born in 646, sometime in that time frame, although one of the articles in Interpretation, which was upon first reading, was too complicated for my little mind to really follow all the twists and turns. There's a guy who wants to argue that Jeremiah probably was born 20 years later than that. It's kind of a new theory, and of course scholars have to argue about that. But he wants to deal with an overwhelming problem in Jeremiah, and that is that Jeremiah seemingly knows nothing about Josiah's reform, which would have taken place sometime early, at least maybe the beginning of his ministry or something, and he doesn't seem to know it. At least he makes no big case of it, and that's a problem if it was as big a deal as Kings seems to think it was. So you can, I'm not going to solve that because I couldn't keep up with all the arguments, and besides it, we're going to run out of time anyway. Now, in order to get some background the first verse, the words of Jeremiah, the son of Hilkiah of the priests, who were in Anatot in the land of Benjamin. Priests in Anatot. What's the significance of that? Well, in order to get that, you'll have to look at 1 Kings 2:26 and 27. And then In order to understand a little bit more, you have to go back to 1 Samuel 30, verse 7. You can just write those down and look them up. And I'll just tell you the story briefly in 1 Kings 2. 1 Kings 1 and 2 deal with the death of David and the ascension of Solomon. Adonijah, one of David's sons, makes a power play against Bathsheba, who has plotted with Nathan, so that Bathsheba wants to establish Solomon as the king in David's place. Adonijah wishes also to be king, and he plays a kind of an end run going to Bathsheba, wanting to marry Abishag, which would have given him some claim to the throne. Abathar, the priest, David's priest, sides with Adonijah, and he loses because Solomon becomes king. Solomon spares Abathar's life, but sends him to Anatoth and blocks the door ever to come to Jerusalem to serve again. So it's a priesthood that can't practice in Jerusalem. That's probably important for Jeremiah's psychology about the folks in Jerusalem. He is an outcast among these priests who are out. So that maybe will help you understand a little bit about what that first phrase means. He belongs to that the priests who lost. Okay, now we'll just spend a minute looking at chapter 1. Now the word of the Lord came to me, saying, "Before I formed you in the womb, I knew you. Before you were born, I consecrated you. I appointed you a prophet to the nations." No election here. No decision here. In fact, he tries to decide out. But there is no denying, because God has chosen him. And if you want a psalm parallel, you could look at Psalm 139. And that psalm, I think, can be read both as comfort and as fear. You can't escape God, nor can you get away from any place you go. His presence will be there. So Jeremiah says, well, wait a minute here. I'm only a youth. And I love the way God talks to Jeremiah from the very beginning. He tells him, shut up and don't you say I'm only a youth. And he says, do not say, I am only a youth, for to all to whom I send you, you shall go, and whatever I command you, you shall speak. Do not be afraid of them, for I am with you to deliver you. I am with you to deliver you. Jeremiah must have wondered about those words down in Egypt when he finally was assassinated or whatever happened to him down there. Jeremiah must have wondered where those words were when he was up to his armpits in the mud in the cistern. I will deliver you, a strange deliverer. Then the Lord put forth his hand and touched my mouth, and the Lord said to me, behold, I have put my words in your mouth. See, I have set you this day over nations and over kingdoms. Now, what is the nature of Jeremiah's ministry? It's very clearly stated. To pluck up and to break down, to destroy and to overthrow, to build and to plant. And if you go to Jeremiah 45:4, you meet the same language at the conclusion of his ministry. God kind of says that's what it was all about. Okay. In verse 11, and the word of the Lord came to me, saying, Jeremiah, what do you see? Part of the role of the prophet is to see things differently, to see things as they are. Then we have a play on words. I see a rod of almond. Notice if you have an RSV, shaked, as opposed then to the other word, shaked. So that just by one vowel, we change the meaning from a rod of almond. And then the Lord said to me, you have seen well, for I am watching over my word to perform it. The almond rod and seeing. And then you'll notice how much seeing plays a part in Jeremiah's ministry. Notice immediately now, the word of the Lord came to me a second time, saying, what do you see? And I said, I see a boiling pot, Babylon, or God himself, facing away from the north. Then the Lord said to me, out of the north evil shall break forth upon all the inhabitants of the land. For lo, I am calling all the tribes of the kingdoms of the north, and they're going to come for them. But then Jeremiah has this ministry in verse 17, but you gird up your loins, arise, and say to them everything that I command you. Do not be dismayed by them, lest I dismay you before them. Do you see the hard place where Jeremiah is? I mean, if you're going to let them get to you, I'm standing right here and I'll get to you. I mean, that's the fix Jeremiah is in from the very beginning. Behold, I make you this day a fortified city, an iron pillar, and bronze walls, and so on. He's going to make him this strong person. But Jeremiah is going to pay like everything to be set against his people. Because what he finds himself as he is set against his people is that he is set between God and his people, like being in a big vise. Chapter 3, very quickly. If a man divorces his wife and she goes forth from him and becomes another man's wife, will he return to her? Would not that land be greatly polluted? You have played the harlot with many lovers. Would you return to me, says the Lord? If God keeps his word, if God is bound by his own law in Deuteronomy 24, then God may not take his people back. If this image holds. Because once you have put a wife aside, she's gone to another husband, and you bring her back, that is to pollute the land. Now that's exactly what Hosea does. God tells Hosea to break his law in order to show God's love for his people. And God is saying, in essence, I'm going to do the same thing. You can look it up in Deuteronomy 24. That's why he talks about poetic passion and stunning imagery. God takes back this prostitute, this despicable woman, breaks his own law to do it. Really interesting about God. You know, God is in many ways the biggest breaker of his own law. Interesting. We could spend a whole week on that concept, but it's really true. If you begin to look at the prophets and the way they talk about the way God acts, God's love always overwhelms truth and everything else. That's another sermon. Moving on then to chapter 4, verse 5, because we want to talk about this God who's involved in the public arena of history. Declare in Judah and proclaim in Jerusalem and say, blow the trumpet through the land, cry aloud and say, assemble, let us go into the fortified cities, raise a standard toward Zion, flee for safety, stay not. For I bring evil from the north and great destruction. A lion has gone up from his thicket. A destroyer of nations has set out. He has gone forth from his place to make your land a waste. Your cities will be ruins without inhabitant. For this gird you with sackcloth, lament and wail, for the fierce anger of the Lord has not turned back from us. Another reference in order to flesh this out, look at Jeremiah 25, particularly beginning at verse 8, and you will see that Babylon is identified as that agent of God who is coming against them. And I've already talked about what patriotic heresy it was to name Nebuchadnezzar as the servant of God, Evid Yahweh. That's just almost impossible to say in one breath, to have such a ruler as Nebuchadnezzar to be God's servant. And then another thing, if we'll move over, please, to chapter 5. And again, I'm just picking up some things so that you can perhaps read this and study it on your own. Verse 2, we could look at verse 1 in which he goes about searching in the streets like, who was it, Socrates, looking for one honest man. Jeremiah does the same thing. And in verse 2, though they say, as the Lord lives, yet they swear falsely. The word for falsehood here is used, according to Weisel anyway, 72 times in the Old Testament. one half of them in Jeremiah. And you can see that if you glance over to verse 12 of that same chapter. They have spoken falsely of the Lord and have said, He will do nothing, no evil will come upon us, nor shall we see sword or famine. The prophets will become wind, the word is not in them. Thus shall it be done to them. The prophets are nothing but going around passing gas. It's no big deal, so don't worry about it. Okay? In an effort to get through this so we have a little time to visit, I'm going to just pair up some things for you right now. If you read the sermon that's in chapter 7 about trusting the temple, Jeremiah tells them in 7:4, do not trust in these deceptive words, this is the temple of the Lord, the temple of the Lord, the temple of the Lord. For if you truly amend your ways and your doings, if you truly execute justice one with another, if you do not oppress the alien, the fatherless, or the widow, or shed innocent blood in this place, and if you do not go after other gods to your own hurt, then I will let you dwell in this place. That's the Deuteronomic theology. You've got to keep the commandments. You've got to keep them if you're going to dwell in this land. So Jeremiah preaches Deuteronomy. It just doesn't work out in his own life. That's one of the points that I want to make and come to that conclusion by the end of next session. Then I will let you dwell in this place in the land that I gave of old to your fathers forever. Now, if you don't think God is willing to destroy his own temple, Jeremiah goes on to tell them, then I suggest that you run up to Shiloh and see what happened up there. Because he says, historically, those turkeys thought that since they had this nice worship place, they had this real nice church, they went to church regularly, they kept the offering up, they had a good choir, they paid the pastors well. They just happened not to take that any place with them. Just go up there to Shiloh and see what that church looks like. Like we could go to some of our inner city churches and see what they look like today because they wanted to stay only with the Norwegians or whoever and didn't care to take care of the folks that came. Just go visit them sometime. Compare this also to chapter 26 because that's the narrative that gives the context for this passage. Okay, moving right along, because we've got to get into some of the fun stuff here, and not that it isn't all fun if you're kind of perverted and like people getting it in the neck. In chapter 19, we meet one of Jeremiah's acted out parables when he is told by God to go down and buy a potter's flask. And then he's supposed to take some of the boys out in the valley and give a little sermon and smash the thing. And so he goes through that and he gives this little sermon that's the first part of it through 1:9. Then in verse 9 of chapter 19, I want you to look at something just because I want to make another biblical connection. And I will make them eat the flesh of their sons and their daughters, and every one shall eat the flesh of his neighbor in the siege and in the distress with which their enemies and those who seek their life afflict them. That's pretty gory stuff, right? Then all you need to do is to read the Lamentations, read the book of Lamentations, and look at chapter 2, verse 20, and chapter 4, verse 10. Easy to remember those two, because 2 times 20 is 40, and 4 times 10 is 40, and so Lamentations, you got it made. And it talks about women eating the flesh of their own children. That's how bad the destruction got. There's no pussyfooting around here. When God comes to war against us, he's dead serious. That's part of what holy war means. So you don't play around much with this God. Okay, then we could look at chapter 27 to 29, and I'm just going to point these out to you so that you can go and read them yourselves. 27, 28, and 29 deal with his confrontation with his prophets, with his prophetic counterpoints. We've talked about the yoke of wood. Hananiah breaks it, says that it's only going to be 2 or 3 years that they're in exile. scholarship thinks that this scene occurred between 597 and sometime before 587, because the first deportation took place. Nebuchadnezzar carried off a bunch of the folks in 597, and so they were wondering, what are we going to do in the midst of all of this? And Hananiah comes with a positive word. Well, God is going to turn everything around. And so he smashes that wooden yoke. Jeremiah gets an iron one, and then they have another confrontation. It's kind of a fun conflict that they have. Notice it in chapter 28, verse 8. Jeremiah is telling them, "The prophets who preceded you and me from ancient times prophesied war, famine, and pestilence against many countries and great kingdoms. As for the prophet who prophesies peace, when the word of that prophet comes to pass, then it will be known that the Lord has truly sent the prophet." Jeremiah is saying, historical precedent is on my side, preaching doom. And then he also says, I think, Hananiah, that you're going to kick the bucket in the next year or so, and in 2 months he's dead. I mean, you're going to mess around with a prophet like Jeremiah? Well, they do anyway. Chapter 32. We're going to skip 31, and hopefully I'll be able to deal with it tomorrow, because it has to do with the new covenant and is the heart in many ways of Jeremiah. In chapter 32, in the second verse, we find Jeremiah the prophet was shut up in the court of the guard, which was in the palace of the king of Judah. For Zedekiah, king of Judah, had imprisoned him, saying, "Why do you prophesy and say, 'Thus says the Lord, behold, I am giving this city into the hand of the king of Babylon, and he shall take it?'" And then he goes on, to tell him that in the midst of all of their conversations, that you keep talking like this, and the army's going to be demoralized, and the people are, don't say those negative things. Governments never have liked folks who say negative things, even if they're true. While he's in prison, one of his uncles comes down to strike this real estate deal that we talked about. And so so he goes ahead and buys it. And notice the reason he gives in verse 15 of chapter 32. "For thus says the Lord of hosts, the God of Israel, houses and fields and vineyards shall again be bought in this land." That's the hope. It's interesting. When nobody has any doom, Jeremiah's got enough for everybody. And when there isn't any hope, he's got enough for everybody. He's an interesting guy. Then let's see, to move on. I want to deal with one of the most fun stories. Chapter 36, if you will, quickly. One of the things that, if you read carefully in the material, you will find that families are dividing over the ministry of Jeremiah. And when Jeremiah has been banned from the king's presence, so he dictates this scroll to Baruch and sends Baruch in. I imagine Baruch appreciated it a whole lot. Realizing what had happened to Jeremiah, and that probably he was a good candidate for the same thing. And then when he preaches this word, you'll notice in verse 10, it talks about Jeremiah, the son of Saphan, the secretary, and they're the people who rat on Baruch, who go in and tell the king what's going on. And then if you go over to the end of, or to chapter 39, verse 14, you'll find out who saves Jeremiah. Now, this is very interesting to me. It's a detail, I don't know how, I just didn't happen to fall asleep between the two passages, so it struck me that this is kind of interesting. They entrusted him to Gedaliah, the son of Achiahim, the son of Shaphan. In other words, in Shaphan's own family, you have one of his grandsons who saves Jeremiah, and you have one of his sons who turns Jeremiah in, or turns in Baruch, divides families. Okay, now so they come in and Baruch comes into the king's or the scroll comes into the king's presence, and we'll pick the story up in verse 20, because it's one of these biblical stories that, again, if we hear it read, we can see what artistry the author has in terms of a story well told. So they went into the court of the king, having put the scroll in the chamber of Elishama, the secretary. And they reported all the words to the king. Then the king sent to Jehuda to get the scroll, and he took it from the chamber of Elishama the secretary, and Jehuda read it in to the king and all the princes who stood before the king. It was the ninth month, and the king was sitting in the winter house, and there was a fire burning in the brazier before him. Interesting little detail, isn't it? I mean, here they bring this. We haven't heard anything about what time of the year it is or anything. And here's the king sitting there like it used to be here in Koinonia with the fire going while we're having this. And so they start to read the scroll to him. And he very nonchalantly pulls out his little penknife. As Jehuda read three or four columns, the king would cut them off with a knife, throw them into the fire. Just as cool as can be, saying, this is what I think of Jeremiah's words. Take them very lightly. And then you'll notice that the folks who are around, it says, he burned them, and it says, yet neither the king nor any of his servants who heard all these things was afraid, nor did they rend their garments. What did Hezekiah do, Josiah do when they found the words of the scroll in Kings? When they read the words of Deuteronomy, the first thing that Josiah does is he tears his clothes off and says, we are really guilty around here. Not this turkey, and nor anybody around him. That's how bad things are. Okay, now... just a couple of things I'm going to say, and you'll just have to take my word for it, and then you can go look it up. Jeremiah, of course, in his support of the Babylonian option, if you will, tells the people, when you go over into exile in Babylonia, pray for the welfare of that nation, work for its welfare, because in its welfare is your welfare. He also tells them, hey, all of the people that amount to a hill of beans are going to Babylon. All of them. There isn't going to be anybody left here worth warm spit. But what does Jeremiah do? He chooses to stay after he's told them that the future rests with the exiles. Interesting. I wonder why. It beats me. And then, of course, as one kind of last irony in Jeremiah's life, when some of the folks flee down to Egypt to take the Egyptian option, they drag Jeremiah along as a rabbit foot. They go back to worshiping Ishtaroth, the Egyptian goddess of the heavens, and Jeremiah gives them hell for that. The last thing we hear of him. But his life is just filled with irony. We're going to see tomorrow when we look at the complaints in terms of how he understood this or didn't understand it, how he attempted to make sense of all of this. The point we hopefully have made is that Jeremiah is a complex, interesting, fascinating person, and I think should give those of us who are preachers, and by that I think I mean all of the church, some indication about what it means to boldly proclaim what we have heard. Okay, we got 10 minutes to do some visiting.
We have prophets today. How do we identify them? If I had been living in Jeremiah's time, which would I have believed him or would I not? Who is Jeremiah today? How do I identify? That may be off the subject.
But no, that's... unfortunately, it's right on the subject. And I haven't got any good answers. That's what bothers me. See, it's interesting. I'm going to now kind of digress, and hopefully everybody will forget the question by the time. I think the Bible had the same, obviously had the same problem. And when the Deuteronomist wrote Deuteronomy, and he stuck in, I think it's chapter 18, and there will a prophet arise likened to me, you know, God is gonna, like Moses. And then the criteria is, how will you know whether he's a true prophet or not? And the word is, his word will come true. Okay, that seems fairly easy to have a criteria. The problem is you got to let history work it out. Now, the other thing I think we need to say about prophets, that prophets are not so much people who look into the distant future. I don't read any of the prophets on the primary level that way. That's not what they were about. They dealt with stuff close at hand. They were basically people who, as I indicated earlier, who saw with some perception what others willed not to see. And in other words, Jeremiah could see connections that for whatever reasons, the other folks in Judah were not willing to see, not able to see. And so he could say, the future is with Babylon all the way. Other people refuse to see that. I think that if we're going to look at prophets in our own time, well, I'll give you a little personal example, and this is the way that pastors help to feather their own nests and try to make your own excuses and put people off. I tell my people, when I preach on things that really get under your skin, that probably is the time most to listen. Now, you can see what that does for preaching, right? And when I give them hell and they don't like it, then I tell them, well, it's because you need to hear it. But I really believe that one of the ways you can maybe start to test a prophet out is, does that really challenge stuff that's really close to you? You know, one of the things that I see, and I'll use contemporary examples, is in terms of be the government, business, or church officials who really dislike certain kinds of criticism. It may well be that that's precisely, whether it's valid or not, they better listen to that to examine what they are about. I don't do a real good job of it myself, but I think that the most important ingredient for any of us who want to be faithful people is the ability to be self-critical. And I have real difficulty seeing too well self-critically. And that's why these folks who want to burr into me, who I would rather walk across the other side of the street than to engage them in conversation. Those are my prophets, and I think societally we have prophets that, when they get under our skin, that may be a clue. I don't know. That's a long answer to your question, but seemingly the biblical, and even prophets of hope, when they were speaking words of hope, people were in such despair they couldn't hear them, and they needed to have that get under their skin. When we don't believe that we are worth anything, and you know, and depreciate ourselves and have such little self-esteem, we need to trust the word that says you are accepted, forgiven, God's grace comes to you. We need to, I mean, a lot of us have real trouble with that one. Okay, that's a sermon, not an answer. See, nobody now dares ask a question. Make a comment then that I can't possibly address.
In the first chapter of Jeremiah, it starts out with, I knew you before you were born. Some other religions tend to use that as a evidence of predestination. What is your opinion?
Well, not only some other religions, but certainly strands within our tradition. I guess if you were going to look at a real blatant example of that, you could look in the New Testament material in Ephesians, the first chapter, beginning at the third verse, make the claim that before the foundation of the world, we have been known and loved and destined to be His children. That's pretty bold kind of statements. And I tend to think, and this is my rationalization and way out of dealing with that question, is that for those of us who know ourselves to be God's people, we can rest assured that selection is deep in the heart of God, which we speak of temporally in that sense, in the time categories. And without necessarily having to address the second question, which is what about those that weren't elected? That's always where we get hung up. And it seems to me Paul suggests in Romans 10 that what you do about that is you go out on the mountaintops barefooted and preach, because they need to hear. How can they believe if they've not heard, and how can they hear without a preacher?
I was wondering to what extent pastors can be prophets, and does that just show my ignorance towards prophets? They haven't asked that question.
Well, had you been here yesterday, you would have been blessed with the answer. I'll give you the answer again just for the others who weren't blessed, too. I think it's a false dichotomy to make to play off preachers against or pastors against prophets. Because as I said yesterday, what we may hear as prophetic, others will hear as pastoral. Martin Luther King Jr. was a pastor to his people and a prophet to us. And I just think it's a false dichotomy to say you can't be a pastor and a prophet. I think if you're pastoral to people, you've got to be prophetic in this kind of world, because there's somebody grinding the SOBs down. I mean, that's just... So you just inevitably are going to be caught up on one side. It depends on who's listening, here and then over here.
Yeah. I was just interested in your comment that God is the biggest breaker of his own laws, and exactly what you mean.
Okay, I'll use two examples just very quickly. If you read Hosea 11, which is the heart, I believe, of Hosea's gospel, Hosea begins an indictment against Israel. It is the indictment of a rebellious son. If you go to Deuteronomy 21 and look, just follow through the commandments, the ordinances about what you do with a rebellious son, an incorrigible son, you can't get him in shape, you take him to the elders at the city gate, they verify that this guy is incorrigible, and then you stone him to death. So in the court scene in Hosea 11, every indictment indicates that Israel is a rebellious, incorrigible son, therefore deserves death. But then finally Hosea cries out for God, "How can I give you up? How can I make you like Admah? For I am God, the Holy One in the midst of you, and not man." So God breaks his own law in that sense, that he cannot write Israel off, even though by Deuteronomy 21 he should be written off. The same thing is true, as I indicated, if you combine Jeremiah 3 and Hosea 1 and 3, in which God tells Hosea, particularly in 3, to go and marry this woman that he was married to before, who's gone off and taken another man. And Deuteronomy 24 is very clear about that. You never take such a woman back, because that is an abomination in Israel. And yet he tells his prophet to do it. Why? To demonstrate his love for his rebellious people. So he breaks his own laws. And that should be some kind of clue.
Paul, is there a comment on the predestination question? What I understood was that God knows, before the foundation of the world, he tied up that he was going to give everybody a free will, and so he knew that he would, could it be that he knew, even before the first person ever walked the earth, just what everybody, whoever would live on earth, he knew exactly what they would do and what options they would take. And therefore he knew ahead of time, being God, who would select to follow the truth and who would not. And therefore he would know ahead of time who was going to be saved and who would not be saved. Not that he said, "You're going to be saved and you're not." Just that he knew ahead of time because who he is.
Well, that's the whole question of divine foreknowledge, and in American Lutheranism, you've got a whole, you can trace synods back to that question. And the problem with the question, you see, this is where the Jewish tradition will teach us something. What if something doesn't mean just one thing? And what does it mean to hold two things in tension? Because as soon as you resolve that predestination, divine foreknowledge question, you have other questions. And so, in order to live life in this world where we don't understand everything, I think you live with paradoxes.